We'll hear the arguments from the appellees.
May it please the court. Counsel. My name is Dennis Johnson, and I have the privilege today of arguing this case on behalf of the plaintiffs. Seated at the counsel table with me are Camilla Taylor and Ken Upton, my co-counsel from Lambda Legal. The first words of the Iowa Constitution say that all men and women are by nature free and equal. These words, being located at the beginning of our Constitution, provide a compelling promise of freedom and equality for all Iowans. The history of this section reveals an even more compelling promise. This section initially read, "All men are by nature free and independent." And in 1857, in the Constitutional Convention, that section was amended and the phrase "free and independent" was changed to "free and equal." And the minutes of that Constitutional Convention say that change was made so that Iowans could be guaranteed the greatest liberty, freedom, and equality that words could describe. In 1998, that section was again amended, and women were explicitly added to the Freedom and Equality Clause. And that sent a message that discrimination and inequality in Iowa on the basis of sex would not be tolerated under this Constitution. The state of Iowa and the Iowa Supreme Court in particular have taken this promise of freedom and equality very seriously. As this court knows, it has been far ahead of other states and the United States Supreme Court in recognizing constitutional rights and personal liberties of Iowans. My clients, six same-sex couples, come here today seeking freedom of choice and marriage equality as they have a right to do under the Iowa Constitution. Now, this court has had a fairly extensive discussion with the attorneys for the appellant regarding the constitutional issues at play. Before we discuss specific constitutional issues, I do want to address a question that I know is lurking in this case, and that is the question of whether it was proper for the trial court to grant summary judgment or whether there are disputed issues of fact that would justify or require a remand. Our position, very simply, is that this court right now has before it the most complete and the best record it could ever have to decide this kind of a case. What I think it's important for the court to realize is that some affidavits were excluded from evidence by the trial court because he didn't think that they were appropriate expert affidavits. But in the record, in this court, I think if you haven't reviewed them, I'm sure you will, when you see them, you'll see that they don't contain any information that would change the outcome of this case. And I also think this court should keep in mind that this case was pending for a year and a half before it was submitted on summary judgment. Depositions of experts and people who claimed to be experts were taken all over the world, and all of those depositions are in the record. And I can assure you that if there were some kind of sociological or psychological studies that showed that there were problems with same-sex parents or that there were reasons that are compelling to prohibit same-sex couples from getting married, those studies and that information would be in the record because these cases are not decided in a vacuum. You know, you've got about 24 or 25 amicus briefs in this case. National advocacy groups follow these cases around. They offer assistance and help whether you want it or not. And I can tell you, if they had a good study, if they had any kind of good evidence, they would have been waving it all over the courtroom. But it didn't happen because it's not there.
Why should these studies be excluded, though? I mean, what basis?
Your Honor, actually no studies were excluded. That's what I think is important. If you look at the record, five affidavits of their witnesses were excluded, which contained the personal opinions of these witnesses. They did not cite to sociological or psychological studies really not at all. I think one of them tried to get in one remote study.
Is that stuff, though, required under our liberal rule of expert testimony here? I mean, we don't have Daubert. I mean, we have a liberal rule, and if it's helpful to the judge, we admit it and let the judge weigh it. And this judge just ignored it.
Well, Your Honor, I think he examined it. I think he read the affidavits, and it's an abuse of discretion standard. And I think he basically concluded that the so-called expertise of these experts didn't qualify him to answer the questions. The people whose affidavits were excluded included three people from McGill University Department of Religion in Canada. They were trained basically in religious studies. Another person whose affidavit was excluded was trained in economics, history, and government. And another person was a historian. And all of them were trying to talk about the need for biological parents, for different sex couples, matters that are really left to sociology and psychology.
Counsel, do our traditional rules for the admission of expert testimony really apply in cases such as this and to legislative or constitutional facts as opposed to adjudicative facts?
Your Honor, I think what you've got here is possibly a slight blend of both, but let me explain. I think that any expert witness affidavit submitted in court is an adjudicative fact. I don't think that you would ever consider those legislative facts. The information contained in those affidavits might very well refer to legislative facts, which this court can and frequently does take note of. And that's why I'm saying that record, whatever it is, it's here. And if you find any legislative facts referred to in those affidavits, this court is free to consider those legislative facts, as it always does. But I think when you really read these affidavits from these witnesses who were excluded, what you see is people who really didn't have qualifications to express opinions and they wanted to express their own opinions. Those, I don't think, are legislative facts. And I think those are subject to the rules of evidence. And I think that the court had the right to exclude them, and it's an abuse of discretion standard. So that's what I think is the most important thing. And this court has made it clear in numerous cases that when you consider the constitutionality of statutes, I think the words this court has used are you consider matters of common knowledge and common report in the history of the times. And you certainly do consider legislative facts. And you don't always rely on the parties to get them for you. This court, I think, finds them on its own, and I think you're free to do it. But like I said, given the history of these cases and the interest of national advocacy groups, you don't really have to look very far because the best information from both sides is already in this record.
Well, and in fact, in terms of sociological studies and so forth, it seems that there's not much out there. There's a lot of volume, but in terms of high-quality, controlled studies on a wide range of issues, they probably don't exist. If you want to contest that, do. But if that is so, and if it's a rational basis analysis here, isn't the burden on you to challenge the legislative classification that's been made?
Your Honor, first of all, if we're talking rational basis, yes, we do have the burden. And as you know, we think strict scrutiny applies. But on the rational basis issue, we do. And I'd be happy to talk about that because the claimed purposes of the state's interest in this case not only are not furthered by this exclusion from marriage of same-sex couples, but in fact, there's just a total disconnect. There's almost no relationship between keeping same-sex couples and their families from benefiting from marriage and accomplishing these supposed purposes. If we look, for example, at the purpose that the state claims is procreation, promoting procreation among different sex couples, it's clear that different sex couples were getting married and will always get married whether same-sex couples are allowed to participate in that institution. And it's clear that they'll have kids or not have kids based on their own personal choices and not what same-sex couples are doing. In terms of
if the state endorses same-sex marriage, won't that encourage children in same-sex marriages? And where does that lead you, if true?
Your Honor, it might encourage it. It's somewhat speculative, but I think when people are married and they have a stable environment, they're probably more likely to have children. I don't see that there's any problem with that. I don't think that the state has claimed that there's any problem with that. It's established policy in this state. Aside from sociological studies, it's established policy in this state that gays and lesbians and same-sex couples are perfectly proper parents.
If you go back to this rational basis test, we had a recent case, State versus Mitchell, where we said when you're attacking it, you're going to have to present some evidence that there is no rational basis. And that's a very recent case before this was all briefed, but how do you respond to that passage in the Mitchell case?
Well, Your Honor, as I recall from that Mitchell case, the court may have said that, but it also examined the alleged purposes, and I recall that there was a lengthy discussion of whether the statute was over-inclusive and under-inclusive.
Well, that was a dissent. The majority of this court said you have to present evidence to show that there's no rational basis.
Well, I think it said we had to refute the claimed rational basis. I'm not sure that, I don't recall a specific indication of a trial.
And where is that evidence in this record?
Well, Your Honor, frankly, what we have to do is basically, I guess, start off with saying there is no rational basis for this exclusion because the benefits of same-sex couples entering into marriage are the same as they are for heterosexual couples, and they are similarly situated. And what we have to do is anticipate what the state will claim as purported benefits and try to refute them.
But your, but your argument falls or rises on whether marriage is the fundamental right or same-sex marriage is a fundamental right. And I think, as I understand what you're arguing, is that marriage is the fundamental right.
That's right.
Now, if you go to marriage as a fundamental right, it's, I understand there's a bunch of reasons, but where do you stop? How do you stop more than two people getting married then if marriage is a fundamental right?
Your Honor, what you have to do, and really I think you have a two-part question. First is, what is the fundamental right we're talking about? And then how do we draw the line between possible multi-party marriages? And let me try to answer both. First, the fundamental right we're talking about here is the right to marry. And this court and the United States Supreme Court have made it very clear that if you are going to analyze a fundamental constitutional right, you have to be careful how you frame the issue, or you might answer the question just by the way you asked it. One of the things you look to is history and tradition to see if this right is a time-honored right and tradition in this society. If you go back to the fundamental right to marriage, what you do is you see that people have always had a fundamental right, they've always had a right to marry. Now, the question is, what is the nature of that right? And this court has made it clear in Callender versus Skiles and other cases that you don't analyze the fundamental right on the basis of who has been allowed to exercise it in the past. Rather, you look to the attributes and substance of the right itself.
And how do you limit it to just two people if you don't look at the tradition about marriage has always been between two people?
Well, Your Honor, the tradition, first of all, marriage is an institution between two people, and it is highly regulated by the state. I think.
Haven't you just defined marriage? I mean, I understand your argument very well on the definitional issue, but you've just said, well, marriage is between two people. Well, aren't you doing the same boxing in of definitions that the defendants are?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because, and here's the reason. Marriage is highly regulated and highly defined in this state, always has been. We have hundreds of statutes, hundreds of cases interpreting various legal rights and obligations for marriage. It's always been in the context of two-person marriage. Now, if you want to get into something like polygamy or bigamy, that is really suggesting a change in the nature of the institution.
Well, isn't it's same-sex marriage changing the institution?
See, that's where I respectfully disagree, Your Honor, because, first of all, the institution is what is established by the state, not who's allowed to participate in it. If the same-sex couples are in this courtroom are allowed to marry, my marriage will not be affected at all. I will continue to operate under exactly the same sets of rules and laws that I always have. And they will operate under exactly the same set of laws and rules that we operate
under. How will three people being married change your relationship or their relationship?
It won't, but they'll have to operate under a completely different set of laws and rules. And that's the reason, because once you get to three or four or five people, then you have a situation where you have questions of consent, presumptions regarding parenthood, dissolutions could present unique problems, inheritance could present unique problems, custody problems. It would require an entirely new array of statutes and case law. It would essentially be a new institution. We're not suggesting a new institution. We're suggesting that everybody be able to participate equally in the institution that's existed since the beginning of this state. And in terms of the fundamental right, you know, I think it's important to keep in mind that that the fundamental right, the nature of the right we're talking about here, really stems from the Due Process Clause, which respects individual liberty and freedom of choice in very private personal matters and family relationships, areas where the government shouldn't be allowed to intrude. It doesn't depend on who's been allowed to exercise that right. The reason for that fundamental right is because of that right to privacy and liberty. My clients have exactly the same constitutional rights as everybody else. They choose to marry someone of the same sex. Well, that doesn't change the fact that that's their choice. So I think that's why this is, in fact, a fundamental right. I don't think it's a fundamental right to same-sex marriage. I think it's a fundamental right to marriage. And I think that's why it should be subject to strict scrutiny.
Well, counsel, opposing counsel agrees with your analysis, except they back it up and say, fine, but define what marriage is, and they go through the long history, the centuries of definition of what marriage is between a man and a woman. How do you mesh those two concepts and back out the definitional concept as not an issue in defining the fundamental right?
Your Honor, this court has really kind of conducted that kind of analysis on a few occasions, not in the marriage context. But in analyzing the fundamental right, the question is never who has been allowed to exercise it, because if one person can exercise a fundamental right, everybody should be able to. And if you only allow people to exercise fundamental rights who have been allowed to historically, that means groups who have been discriminated against won't be allowed to. With that in mind, this court in Callender versus Skiles, I think it's a very important decision for this kind of a case, because it analyzed the fundamental right of a biological father to assert paternity for a child born of a woman who was married to another man. This court said, we've never had this situation arise before because he was basically an adulterous father. They couldn't find any basis for his right to assert paternity in the Iowa common law or statutes. And in fact, the United States Supreme Court had decided in an identical case that there was no fundamental liberty interest in parenting. But this court said that's not the case because we examined the fundamental liberty interest, parenting, not who's been allowed to exercise it in the past, just what is the nature of the interest. And then this court said, under those circumstances, that interest is still here. He has a fundamental liberty interest. So that's where I think is the important distinction. You've got to look at the attributes of the right. What is the right at stake? And here it's freedom of choice, freedom from governmental interference in who you marry. And that right should be the same for everybody.
When you're talking about the right at stake, do you disagree that marriage is a constellation of rights? Such as wills and things like that, or do you think marriage is something more?
Your Honor, I think it's everything that you just suggested and more. Certainly it is a bundle of legal rights that give people enormous financial benefits and security and stability, along with some corresponding obligations. But it's also a lot more than that. It's more than just procreation, even though procreation is very important. I think it's the intimate combining of two lives forever, and I think, frankly, in our society, it's maybe the most revered institution there is. I think you know, we all grew up in a society where, you know, you expected that if you led a normal, happy life in America, someday you'd probably get married, and you'd probably have kids, although you might not. Everybody grew up with that expectation, and you don't grow up with that just thinking about the financial rights. It's also the relationship and the family and the identity and the stability that you get. My clients grew up with that expectation, too. And then at some point in their life, they figured out that they wouldn't be allowed to participate in this institution. And that's why we're here trying to solve that.
Why don't you address yourself to the dual gender parenting issue? And by preface, I'm going to quote Justice Ginsburg, who has stated, the physical difference between men and women are enduring. The two sexes are not fungible. A community made up exclusively of one sex is different from a community composed of both. Now, the argument, as I understand it from Polk County, in part, is that dual-gendered parenting, because of these non-fungible features of men and women, create the optimal child-rearing environment. And then they have to make, I think, the next step, which is to say that the marriage statute in Iowa furthers that interest. Would you comment, please?
Yes, Your Honor. First of all, The dual gender parenting, there actually is quite a bit of sociological evidence in the record on that, and what they have concluded from, and this is undisputed evidence, I think both sides' experts agreed with this, the most important thing in child rearing for stability is to have two parents, and it is important for the child to have a good relationship with the primary caregiver, and a good relationship with the secondary caregiver. It's important to have a good relationship between the two parents, and then finances. Those studies all happen to be on different sex couples, but everybody agrees that's most important. In terms of whether there is some kind of an optimal family, whether different gender or same-sex couples are different, there's no evidence to suggest that. What I would suggest, basically, is that this state has already recognized, by allowing same-sex couples to adopt, by allowing same-sex couples to be foster parents, this court has made it clear that sexual orientation is not even a relevant factor in custody decisions, that this state has already basically adopted a policy that same-sex parents are satisfactory. Now, let me just get to this idea of optimal parenting. Let's assume hypothetically, I don't agree with this, but let's assume hypothetically that the optimal environment to raise a child is a man and a woman. Well, that's where we get back to this, even under a rational basis test, there is such a total lack of connection between that stated goal and excluding same-sex couples from marriage that it fails even rational basis and doesn't come close under a compelling state interest strict scrutiny test.
What, wouldn't it necessarily limit the number of children that would be raised in a purportedly inferior setting?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, I don't think that it would. It's possible that, first of all, nobody's ever suggested that same-sex couples provide an inferior setting for raising children. What we're talking about here is some hypothetical optimum setting. And the thing is that, this marriage statute right now allows heterosexuals to get married when we could tell right at the outset that the parents will be bad parents. We will allow convicted sex offenders and pedophiles to get married without even blinking an eye if they meet the other requirements of Chapter 595. And yet my clients are here. They're good parents. They've been approved as foster parents and adoption. They've given birth to their own children. They're denied the access and benefits of marriage. And the question you have to say is, how does trying to provide to encourage this so-called optimum environment for raising children, how is that furthered at all by prohibiting these families from enjoying the benefits of marriage?
But don't we have to accept that as a legislative purpose under a rational basis until you tell us otherwise or prove evidence otherwise under a myriad of our cases?
Well, Your Honor, accepting the optimal environment as a rational basis?
Yeah, the state has a right to... The state has a right and a legitimate purpose to have kids raised in an optimal environment. I mean, can you disagree with that?
No, Your Honor. In fact, I think that the marriage statute clearly does benefit couples with same-sex children.
And if this statute, the way it's written, purports to meet that goal, I mean, how are we to look behind it?
Well, I think under Racy 2, this court has made it clear that you're going to do some probing. You're going to look at the legislative facts out there, matters of common knowledge. You will investigate the sociological studies. You're not just going to take somebody's word for it, particularly when there's such a great body of evidence to the contrary. But, in the rational basis test, we do break it down by first seeing if it's a legitimate purpose, and secondly, then we see if it's rationally related. I really think they fail on the rationally related part. That part they don't even meet. I might also point out, that this statute was adopted in 1998, at a time when Hawaii had approved same-sex marriage in that state. And it's very clear that this statute was adopted for one purpose and one purpose only, which was to exclude same-sex couples from marriage.
Where's the evidence of that in this record?
I don't know how you can read it any other way, Your Honor, frankly. There could be, first of all, my interpretation of the statute before the 1998 amendment was that in all probability, the courts would have said you had to be a male and a female to get married. Couldn't guarantee it because it didn't explicitly say it, but it sure implied it.
The Hawaii case was 93. This statute was amended 98.
Your Honor, I think the Hawaii case was later, if I'm not mistaken. But
first one was 93, where they said sex was a suspect class.
Okay.
In early 93. Now you're talking 5 years later.
Well, again, you know, what I'm talking about here is the fact that the plain language of the statute can evince no other purpose than to keep same-sex couples out. This class was singled out. It was clearly a target of the legislation, and that could be the only conceivable purpose. And I would point out in the record that we have, in fact, attached a lot of information about statements that were made when this amendment was being proposed in the legislature, where they basically said that was the purpose of the statute. There are newspaper articles and things like that, but again, when this court looks at matters of common knowledge, common report, and the history of the times, it's all there, and it's no mystery. I mean, everybody involved knows why they adopted that statute.
Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
When we are making the determination of whether strict scrutiny should be applied on these constitutional questions, courts commonly ask the question whether there's a discrete and insular minority involved, or whether there's disparate treatment of a relatively powerless political group. My question to you is, given some of the recent election results, take, for example, the 1992, I think it was, statewide referendum in Colorado, where I believe 46% of the voters opposed an unfavorable treatment of gay and lesbian folks, and more recently in California, when 47%+ of the voters opposed the ban on a same-sex marriage. Under those circumstances in the political environment, is it realistic for us to view gay and lesbian folks as a discrete and insular minority or a politically powerless group?
I think it is, Your Honor. First of all, in terms of identifying a suspect class, the relative political powerlessness of the class has not always been a requirement. That's debatable. But I think it's still beyond dispute that gays and lesbians in this state are relatively politically powerless. We have never had an openly gay state elected official. We have only a handful of openly gay legislators in this state. And there's a reason for that. It's because if people come out as gay or lesbian, they almost can't get elected in most areas.
Why is that? Where's the evidence of that?
Well, Your Honor,
is that your opinion? I mean,
it is my opinion, but I think it's also a matter of common knowledge and common report of which this court takes notice in assessing the constitutionality of statutes. And it could be that not everyone agrees with that, but you know, I think it's pretty fair to say that people are aware that gays and lesbians are certainly disadvantaged in running for political office.
What about Iowans that say they won't vote for openly gay and lesbian couples? Gay and lesbian people for office? I mean, are you saying Iowa is discriminatory or they're not open-minded? I mean, where do you get this from?
Well, Your Honor, I think Iowans are actually among the most tolerant people in this country, maybe the most tolerant. And I do think someday that they'll vote in favor of gay and lesbian rights if a constitutional amendment comes up years down the road. But we're not there yet. We know that. And certainly, you saw the struggles that they had to get things through the Iowa legislature recently. They finally got sexual orientation in the Civil Rights Act, but that's not the be-all, end-all of it. And I would also point out that women got legislation passed in their favor, but they were still considered a suspect class. That doesn't end the inquiry at that point. So I think, again, and, you know, it's possible that the members of the court won't agree with this, but I do think it's a matter of common knowledge and common report that gays and lesbians are still politically disadvantaged.
I'd like you to address a couple issues that relate to the judicial function. First, what I'll call the Glucksberg problem. And, of course, in Glucksberg, the notion is basically be careful, courts, before you constitutionalize issues because you freeze the legislative process. You know, we've got thousands of pages of record developed here with the sociological studies and so forth. The notion of gay marriage is relatively new, last 40 or 50 years, 30 years, but relatively new. One of the issues before us is, do we really want to freeze off the legislative process? I mean, we'll do our duty, of course, but one of the things we need to consider is to what effect do we have on that? And then the second issue that's also somewhat related is what I'll call the issue of minimalism. As I understand it, and the position of the parties, I think, are aligned, marriage affects hundreds of statutes, maybe even more, but hundreds at least. In one fell swoop, in this case, we're asked to knock down all the dominoes if we rule in a favorable fashion toward your client. Is that an appropriate exercise of judicial power? Are we all really smart enough to know that statute 187 in this line of dominoes does not, for instance, have a rational basis or would not survive strict scrutiny? Would you address those issues, please?
Yes, Your Honor. Let me address the last one first. If you strike Section 595.2, Section 1, the exclusion on which prohibits same-sex couples from marrying, you won't change anything else. There won't be this domino effect where you're undermining other statutes. The Iowa Code, I believe, is gender neutral at this point. The spouses would be there, and I don't think you're going to have any kind of an effect like that. Getting to Glucksberg, Glucksberg said that the court has to be careful in how it frames the issue on the fundamental right under due process, and that's what I was talking about before. If you define it incorrectly, like if you say, is there a fundamental right to same-sex marriage, if you look to tradition and history, you don't find it, and therefore you've answered your own question. You arguably would say no. But you've got to frame the issue correctly, and that's all Glucksberg was saying. And in that case, you know, people were looking for a fundamental right to assisted suicide. And this court looked, the Glucksberg court looked back in history and said it's never been legal anywhere. Therefore, no one was ever allowed to exercise that right. And it was pretty easy at that point to say there's no fundamental right to assisted suicide. In our case, we're dealing with something where people have gotten married. They've been free to join this institution of marriage since the time Iowa was a state and even before that. So some people have had this fundamental right to marriage in our society. It's always been there, but only a few have been allowed to participate. And all we're doing is asking for people to be allowed to participate.
I can ask just one follow-up question, and that is Polk County talks about the corrosive effect of our potential decision, the corrosive effect of your position. And to paraphrase it, the harm may not be obvious, but marriage as an institution is declining. There's less personal responsibility. People end up acting based on their own personal desires and not in support of institution, not behaving traditionally and responsibly, et cetera, et cetera. Would you respond, please?
Yes, Your Honor. First of all, let me say that under Racy 2, this court has made it clear that if a reason is submitted to justify a statute, it has to be credible, it has to be plausible, there has to be a basis in fact. And I don't believe there's any indication that this is anything other than sheer speculation on the part of the county. Secondly, again,
are you saying that there are no state interests that are legitimate at all in maintaining this statute?
The same-sex exclusion? Yes, Your Honor, I am. I don't see any. What we have basically is a situation where if same-sex couples, let me just back up. The marriage statute is a wonderful statute with enormous benefits for different sex couples and their children. We don't dispute any of that. And all these reasons they say that they want to encourage people to enter that institution are basically right. The question is, why are same-sex couples kept out? They have families. They would benefit from the stability, from the financial stability, all of that. And their children would benefit. It would be immensely beneficial to them because of the stability and the recognition, and they'd be treated the same as other Iowans. And there's no justification. They've not been able to articulate one that shows why it would be harmful to let same-sex couples enter into marriage, except for what I think is the highly speculative idea that there might be some erosion 20 years from now if same-sex couples are allowed to enter marriage. But I think some of the earlier questions already indicated that marriage is changing. It has been changing in our society. Why this would contribute to that makes no sense. And I know
don't they have a legitimate state interest to make a last stand, so to speak?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know how barring same-sex couples could be a last stand to what different-sex couples are doing in their marriages. I just keep thinking, you know, I mean, my marriage wouldn't be affected at all by allowing same-sex couples to enter. My decision to get married would have never depended, didn't depend on what anybody else was doing except for me and my wife. And why someone would speculate that if these families benefit from marriage that different-sex couples would be reluctant to get married or something like that, I think is really too speculative.
But can't the government take a bigger picture approach to this and see trends and see where we're going and look out 10 or 15 years or generations and make that effort?
As a general proposition, the government can make those efforts and try to look at the big picture. But under RACI 2, it's going to have to make a little bit more sense than to just speculate. At the very least, somebody should be able to articulate an explanation as to why same-sex marriage would have this effect on different-sex couples, rather than just say it might. To explain it, and the logic is simply not there. And I think
isn't this enough, though, under Mitchell, our recent case on equal protection?
I don't think it is, Your Honor. No, I don't think Mitchell has. It didn't set aside the RACI 2 standard that this court has used in Mitchell or the Ames case that came down a little bit last year. I think you still indicate that you're looking for a plausible, credible reason and that you will probe to see if there's a basis in fact.
You say there's no plausible, credible reason?
For
this distinction?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. None. They have not been able to articulate one, and frankly, I can't think of one.
Well, what about, and I'll close with the view of tradition that look, time immemorial, it's almost a common law argument, if you will, from time immemorial, this is what marriage has been. There's some religious notions out there, perhaps, that the defense of traditional institutions is reason enough. Why does that not satisfy rational basis?
First of all, religious notions of marriage should not be combined with the state's civil contract of marriage. We do have separation of church and state. Tradition. This court and the United States Supreme Court have made it clear that tradition is no justification to continue discrimination, that if the state cannot articulate a reason independent of tradition, they don't have a justification for the statute at all. And really, when people say we want to do this because it's traditional, what they're really saying is we've been discriminating for so long that it's a tradition, so we ought to be able to continue. And they have an obligation to be able to at least articulate an independent reason so that the court can evaluate it.
Mr. Johnson, if we believe that the plaintiffs are entitled to the same rights and benefits of a marriage but not the title, should we consider some form of a civil union as a remedy in this case?
Your Honor, I think that would fall very far short, and let me explain why. First of all, we all know what marriage is. We all grew up in a society that reveres marriage, and everybody knows that is the consummation of a relationship. It's really the ultimate commitment between two people, and it's the ultimate statement about their relationship and their family. If my clients are given civil unions, they will be given a badge, basically, of second-class citizenship. And I can tell you, sometimes the easiest way to analyze these arguments is to turn them on yourself. You know, I'm happily married to a woman I dearly love. If the state told me that we couldn't be married anymore, but I could have a civil union, I'd feel some loss there. If they told me we couldn't be married, we could have a civil union, but other people could get married, I'd be very upset because they would have taken something away. And what I think is really important here is, again, to keep in mind the matters of common knowledge and common report. We've all heard this debate over marriage equality going on throughout the United States. And the reason that this idea of a civil union is brought up so often is because some people think that same-sex couples aren't deserving of marriage and that they feel that their marriages would be demeaned if same-sex couples were allowed to have the same title. We all know those arguments have been made. It's no secret. And if same-sex couples were given the title of civil union, everybody would know it was because, well, people didn't think they deserved the title marriage. That would hurt the respect that they get. It would hurt their dignity. And I can tell you, that, you know, we're dealing with real people here. We have McKinley Barbarowski here, 10 years old, in the courtroom with her parents. You know, she found out that her parents weren't married, and that upset her. She started to cry because she wondered why her family was different than others. And then they tried to find a daycare situation for her, preschool. And they were told by the teacher that McKinley could participate, but she wouldn't be allowed to talk about her family during family week because they weren't married. That hurts people in a serious way. You remember in Brown versus Board of Education, when the United States Supreme Court held that separate schools were not equal, they had a sentence in there that really says it all. They'd said, even if the schools were equal, the children would know that they were being sent to a separate school because they were deemed to be inferior. And the children, they said, it would hurt their hearts and their minds in a way from which they might never recover. These are real harms to people, this lack of respect and dignity and equality. The state of Iowa should have no part in that. The state should give them full marriage equality under the same name as everyone else. I see I'm 10 minutes over. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Council.